Welcome to the Coherence Times, where we dive into the science and the story of quantum computing. I'm your host, Ryan Mandelbaum. Every other week, I sit down with researchers, technologists, and thought leaders to unravel the incredible challenges and breakthroughs that are shaping this generational technology. So whether you're a tech enthusiast, an industry leader, or just somebody who's curious about how quantum computing might change the world, you've come to the right place. So together, we'll demystify the concepts, bust the myths, and explore not just how quantum computing works, but how it can work for you. This season, we've been speaking a lot about what quantum is and its nuts and bolts underlying how it works. And we've also started to talk about how people actually expect to use quantum computers. But maybe we've left just a little bit of an elephant in the room. And that's, when will quantum computers actually outperform classical computers? So for our last episode of the season, I'll be speaking with Abhinav Khandala, who is an experimental physicist at IBM Quantum, who currently leads the Quantum Capabilities and Demonstrations team. Abhinav has been working hard with his team to find validated demonstrations of quantum advantage, or as we'll get into, places where quantum beats classical computing alone. So let's dive right in. Hey, Abhinav, how's it going?
Hey, Ryan. Awesome.
So why don't you tell me a bit about like how you got into this? Is like such a specific thing. Like, how'd you get into it?
I joined IBM about 10 years ago after my PhD. I was working on in experimental condensed matter physics, playing around with these cold fridges that we have. Was doing a lot of nanofabrication, which is the kind of tools that we use to build our qubits. And there were certain skills and certain tools that I wanted to learn. IBM was kind enough to let me come and learn these as a postdoc. Some of our very first experiments here beginning to explore what can one do with a quantum computer. So this was even before we necessarily deployed a quantum system online, even with existing internal devices. We were beginning to think about, okay, what could one do with this if one wanted to potentially study the molecular properties, you know, of some small systems. It was a very complicated experiment for that time. Results we got should have been very discouraging for what the potential of these systems, you know, could have been. But it motivated us even further to ask, hey, are there other tricks that one could come up with to actually extract useful information from these existing noisy devices, even at a small scale, and basically led to, you know, Kristen, Sergey, and Jay inventing error mitigation here at IBM. The next several years were, you know, taking those ideas and trying to get them to work in practice, trying to show this on small scales. Along the way, I was also very interested in trying to understand a lot more about the hardware, trying to understand how furthering my understanding of the hardware could help drive where these demonstrations could actually go. So can you actually leverage knowledge of the gates, of measurement, to do even more impactful things from these devices and really, you know, milk out every little ounce of performance you can get from these?
So basically in the earliest days, like, we don't even have Qiskit yet, right? We have these chips and we have to basically almost hard code them to use these experiments that we're building in order to run, you know, to store quantum information, manipulate quantum information.
Right.
And then, in the sort of interim, and you're just trying to figure out how do we get better and better results out of these noisy devices with these tools like your error mitigation, like
exactly,
you were saying.
Exactly. And yeah, so all of this was a very organic evolution of the software, the method development itself, like these error mitigation tools, the hardware. You know, all of them were kind of going, you know, hand in glove, and they all, you know, over the course of the last 10 years have kind of merged into enabling the kind of things, you know, we can begin to do now, you know, on the scale of, you know, a few tens to 100 qubits, you know, potentially pushing beyond what one can do with state-of-the-art classical methods alone.
So we're going to talk a lot about what we can do now, but I think we'll need to define like a core term that we're going to be talking about a lot today, which is just, what is quantum advantage?
So the first part is, I guess, quite, you know, easy. And, you know, I think people understand that you want you want quantum hardware to perform a task where you have a separation over classical only methods, and you know, and what that means is that you're able to perform this task more efficiently, or cheaper, or more accurately than using a classical algorithm computer alone. The second piece, which is perhaps a little forgotten, and that's why I want to emphasize this a little more, is the validation piece. Is also rigorously validating that the output from your quantum computer is correct, you know, is trustworthy, and this even goes, you know, quantum advantage is such a controversial, you know, but also, you know, it's a kind of term that really gets people going, but even if you take a step back and you want to, you know, ask about how do people compare classical methods, you know,
right.
Like even you have one problem, and you know there could be five different classical methods to address the same problem. How do you determine if, you know, one of those five has an advantage over the others?
Right.
Right. And you have to ask, well, okay, did you get a better solution in terms of more accuracy? You know, was there, you know, shorter runtime to solution? Was it cheaper in terms of resources used? Right. But also, do you trust the solution that you got? Right. And all of this gets very nuanced and complicated, because you often get into a space where there doesn't exist a knowledge of what the exact true answer is.
Got it. So basically, I mean, with quantum, we're truly entering this space where we're running calculations that we don't know what the correct answer is, even with a classical computer, for at least to get the exact answer out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Got it.
And I mean, and this has been the state of even what one could do with classical simulation for decades, right? I mean, they've really, you know, built a system of trying to build trust in what classical solutions, you know, or classical approximations produce in the absence of an exact classical result, right? Or an exact result. And so it's the same process. Now you have a new paradigm of computing, you have a new computational tool. How do you establish trust in that new computational tool? It just turns out it happens to be a quantum computer now, but it's really asking the same questions again and again.
Are there tools that are from, I mean, yes, like you said, something that, you know, we've been trying to make better and better classical computing for a while and introducing these new hardware, new methods, things like that. Are there tools from classical computing that we're sort of porting over to try and establish that quantum is better than classical kind of in this rigorous way?
It's not even a matter of pitting one against the other. There are tools that are being developed in classical that we're actually leveraging to further what one can do with quantum. Mm-hmm. So this also gets back to, you know, a misunderstanding that, you know, some people have often in viewing quantum advantages, you know, a battle of quantum versus classical.
Right.
You know, one can absolutely have a demonstration of quantum advantage where one actually ties in quantum with, you know, perhaps very heavy duty classical resources as well, to outperform what one could do with classical alone. Right, and this is this is perhaps, you know, perhaps even more likely to happen, because you can have part of the workload being shared by classical, where those computers and algorithms are really good at doing part of the job, and then the quantum can do the rest.
This is almost something we've seen, like when GPUs came on the scene too, right? We always talk about these price performance trade-offs, and it's almost like now we have to think about the exact same thing happening with quantum computers.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Before we move on, I wanted to actually ask, first off, I think that a lot of, when I hear the word quantum advantage, the first thing I think is, oh, like quantum's, you know, it's time, it's doing, we've rolled it out and it's doing things that are useful. But indeed, I actually don't think that quantum advantage immediately implies useful, right? Can you get into that?
Yeah, it's certainly not a kind of phrasing that I personally like to get into, because useful I find to be a very relative kind of phrase.
Oh, we've reiterated on the podcast over and over again that, like, it's been useful for physicists for like a long time.
Yes,
so
exactly. Exactly. And then whether something is useful or not can even, you know, come up later on, right? Like, I mean, you might execute a circuit and show separation in performance of that circuit between quantum and classical today. And then 3 years later, someone determines that particular circuit is exactly what, you know, enables an advance in finance or in chemistry, and so this is such a relative, it has a different meaning for so many different people, but also this is something that you can't establish at, you know, at a particular point in time. So I I'd much rather focus on examples of problems, examples on of circuits where one can establish separation with classical alone, and also demonstrate that those problems, those circuits can be executed on the quantum device with trustworthy validated solutions.
Right, you're a physicist or a computer scientist slash physicist slash engineer slash mathematician, whatever you are. And so it's not about like, oh, I'm gonna go off and make $1 jillion with what I'm doing right now. What the thing that really is exciting to you, if I'm getting this right, is just like, this is like a rigorous demonstration of quantum outperforming classical alone.
Right. I mean, I would like to make those $1 jillion as well.
Yeah.
But the second part is also very exciting.
But why does that part excite you? That's really cool to me.
Yeah. I mean, because it's really these are very significant moments in the history of computing, right? What are the kind of tasks we can run, we can execute, computing things very differently using a very different technology. And also, personally for me, it's technology that's being built so close to, you know, very fundamental science discoveries, and that trajectory is, you know, often it spans decades, but you know, particularly in this field, we've seen that to be so such an accelerated timescale between where work of this flavor was just, you know, an academic effort.
Yeah.
Was just about, you know, publishing papers. And now we're actually talking of a computational tool that people can use without having any idea of what the fundamental physics is, you know, that actually enabled building these things.
A bunch of physicists are working for a computer science company, making computers.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
And it is really cool because this is kind of tying that in, is like, every time you make a bigger demonstration of quantum, like, it's not just that you're doing something new and interesting, it's like you're doing something that, like, scientifically has not been done before. Like, you're actually breaking new ground with some of these circuits.
Right, right, absolutely. And even within the field of quantum computing, right, I think another really exciting piece of all of this is for me, for the longest time, people didn't think that one could do anything trustworthy, accurate, useful before there was a device that is fault tolerant,
right?
And we've been really pushing that thinking, right? And saying that no, even with pre-fault tolerant devices, there could be utility. There could be things that one could do which are accurate, trustworthy, and still very challenging for classical computation. And this even within the field of quantum computing, you know, has been, you know, kind of against traditional thinking. And it's been really amazing to see the increasing number of people embrace this, you know, try these things out for themselves and begin to explore what one can do with even existing devices.
And we're sort of at almost like an inflection point right now, right? Can you get into, like, why is it that now is such an exciting time for this search?
Maybe the first thing to say is, you know, we spoke about the absence of an exact solution classically, right? For many problems. And this comes down to, in very simple terms, you know, how large a matrix can you store on a supercomputer? You know,
how many numbers can you compute with at the same time?
Exactly, right. And so if you were at the boundary of like 55 to 60 qubits, for instance, trying to represent that state on, you know, one of the world's leading supercomputers using all the memory, that begins to get impossible.
You need 2 to the that number.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? So if, for instance, you were at, you know, a 30-qubit scale or a 40-qubit scale or even approaching the 50-qubit scale, one could imagine that you could have done this kind of brute force classical computation to produce the result. So one could ask, well, why even have a quantum computer, right? So the first thing that needed to happen was you needed quantum computers to get beyond the scale. And that's what we mean by utility scale, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we have systems now with, you know, 100 plus qubits, you know, and these are well beyond what one can do with brute force classical computation, right? And then the second piece of this is you need them to be able to perform computations accurately, right? So it means that you don't want there to be too many errors. Yes, one can, if we understand the noise, we can manipulate it in ways to undo its effect, but this comes at a price, which has an exponential dependence on what the error rates are.
Right.
Right. Over the last 2 years, we were at median error rates of about 1% on our systems. You know, now we're close to 0.1%. which is actually huge.
Right.
You know, like the 10x might not seem that dramatic, but because of like how exponentially sensitive you are to these error rates, it has, you know, tremendous implications for the kind of computations you can do, the accuracy of the computations you can execute. And so this particularly, so the improvement in scale, when the quantum experience came out, you were at 5 qubits.
Right, now it's
anything that could run on 5 qubits, you could perhaps do on your phone, right? So it was critical to get to, you know, 100+ qubits. It was critical to be able to get to that scale while dropping the error rates, while improving the quality. And also then, you know, aspects of speed. Being able to run many circuits extremely fast is also a crucial part of all of this. So all of this had to come together. And it's now at this point where we're able to execute circuits at this, you know, few thousand gates, at this 5K level, if you've heard this, you know, in the past, where things can get challenging for state-of-the-art classical methods, and your quantum device is able to produce accurate solutions.
Awesome. And so one thing, like, you know, we're talking about there being better, but I think the undercurrent here is, like, actually having some sort of rigorous demonstration that they're better. So how do you rigorously show that quantum plus classical is outperforming classical alone for something?
This is a great question. And so for this, we've tried to bucket our different approaches towards quantum advantage, you know, in three different ways. And each of these gives you the ability to validate rigorously what the solution is. Okay? So maybe the simplest one to start with are problems with efficient classical verification,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, the circuit or the problem is engineered in a way where perhaps you already knew what the actual result is. So there is a known answer to compare to, mm-hmm. right? So you know what the answer is. The person who creates the problem knows what the answer is. But if you didn't provide the answer and you asked either classical simulation folks or quantum experimentalists to try and find out the answer, are they able to do it, right? And then there's a potential competition between the two. And then because you know what the answer is, there is that benchmark to compare against.
Factoring is like the best example of this. I mean, it's not what we're doing right now, but
yes,
that's, you know, like,
exactly.
We know that factoring is really hard. So two methods that compare, you know that the one that gets to the answer faster, you already know, you multiply it together, you check the answer.
Exactly,
is right.
Exactly. That's the classic example, right? And then an examples of things where we're trying right now are, for instance, what are called peaked circuits,
mm-hmm.
right? And these are basically, you know, trying to run random circuits where it's known that where the circuits are engineered in a way that you know the output has, you know, perhaps one bit string that really dominates the output distribution. And this is really a method that was, you know, this was an approach that was proposed by Scott Aronson to try and, you know, solve the verifiability problem of just traditional random circuit sampling.
Right, so a previous way that we were trying to demonstrate these games were, like, we do have a random circuit, just a quantum circuit is basically doing random things, and then from that, you know that there's some amount of, you know, you can kind of figure out what the most likely answers are. But this one is, there's actually a most likely answer that you can kind of inject into the whole thing.
Right, right. And then you can ask, is my quantum computer able to find that particular peak or that most likely
string of bits?
Is my classical simulation method able to do this? And then you can basically compare the two,
mm-hmm.
right? And so this is nice because these are problems where there is this flavor of efficient classical verification, right? Now, two are problems with variational solutions. And what I mean by that is, you know, one flavor of tasks that people hope to run on quantum computers are trying to find ground states, so the lowest energy states of different systems.
Right, and this is like holy grail. Like, quantum would be really good if it could find the ground states.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. this has been, you know, one of like the original motivations of even building a quantum computer.
Right.
You build a quantum computer to simulate and predict what other quantum systems could do, and you want to do this where classical systems can't, right? So the nice thing with variational solutions is that if you get a result from either a classical method or a quantum method, you know that that result places an upper bound on what that lowest energy is.
Got it.
Of that system. And what I mean by upper bound is that energy can't be larger than,
right.
than that. So what that provides you then is an ability to rank solutions. If you produce a lower energy than all previous methods, it means now you have a tighter upper bound.
This might actually be something that's misunderstood, right? Is that it's actually incredibly hard to exactly calculate the ground state. It's like one of the hardest things you can do with a computer.
Exactly.
But we have these quantum methods that are really good at approximating it. And so for this, because we know there is an exact answer that's really hard to get, it's just we can go with these approximations and get closer and closer and closer, right? And then it makes sense that the lowest one wins.
Exactly. That's another example of trying to establish confidence in the result and make a statement of, okay, we got the lowest energy, presumably from a quantum device, that a classical only variational method could not produce. So this is the second bucket. The third bucket comes to observable estimations, which is basically trying to measure often properties of the state, for instance, in quantum simulation. You have a bunch of magnets that are interacting, and you turn on some interactions, and you want to study how the magnet, the net magnet of this interacting system, how does that evolve? How does the net magnetization of this?
Yeah, and this one almost can be treated in a simple, oversimplified way as like a weighted average, almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Of an average system. Yes, an average of the individual spins. And here you're going to ask questions like, okay, how does this property evolve over time, or how does this property evolve as I turn on a particular interaction? Questions like this, which are very relevant in quantum simulation.
Well, if you have like a bunch of coins and they all, let's say the coin can be one value 0 and one value 1, yeah. Then you'd eventually, if you're flipping like a lot of them, then in some system you'd have some average between 0 and 1, like 0.5, and then you could introduce fields to sort of get that number to change.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, that's a nice simple way of looking at it. So these are the kind of tasks one often does in a number of algorithms that people hope to run, particularly in the near term. Mm-hmm. Okay, because these are also the kind of quantities that typically error mitigation methods can really help recover. Mm-hmm. Where even in the absence of fault tolerance, you can be preparing states that are very noisy, that have very low fidelity. But still, you can extract properties of that state, like these averaged quantities, which are very accurate and which are noise-free.
We didn't actually get into this enough, and maybe we'll take a second to talk about it, but this error mitigation is actually quite a large deal for being able to do things in the near term. These techniques that allow you to look at the noise of a system and then essentially do the same thing that like noise-canceling headphones do, or even just extrapolate to what it looks like with no noise to have one of these averages emerge.
Exactly, exactly. And have these averages emerge in a trustworthy, accurate
way. Right.
That's the key of
it. This is actually the hardest one to understand. I think the first two are really clear
right.
what they mean, but this one, like, so we actually have a way to establish like a rigorous sort of boundary within which a right answer has to fall, right?
That's precisely the goal, right? That's precisely the goal. So there are, when you have experimental signal that is noisy, that's non-ideal, there are a whole bunch of things one can do with that signal, in post-processing to try and boost it or try and, estimate what you think the noise-free value is. But then it's very important to ask how many of those post-processing methods or how many of those techniques that one wants to use enable you to track the error you're accumulating, as you make assumptions, as you use different kinds of tools, right? So yes, you want to produce a number that represents your estimation of that particular observable, that particular average. But can you also place error bars on that, which give you confidence that the answer lies within this boundary?
Mm-hmm. And these are not coming from the quantum computer. They're coming from our kind of overall knowledge of the problem and,
No, well, they can come from the quantum computer as well.
Okay.
They can come from the particular error mitigation method as well.
Got it.
But essentially, you want to have trust in all the methods that you employed to get the solution.
So maybe a better way of saying is, like, for me at least, is that there's an independent method to establish this boundary in which the right answer has to fall.
Right.
And then once you've independently established this sort of boundary, then you can try out your different methods and then do your little, you know, classical only versus classical plus quantum and see which one falls within this boundary and which one doesn't.
Yes, yes. I wouldn't say it's entirely independent. I'd say that the process of the computation mm-hmm. gives you a sense of what that boundary is.
Got it.
Right? It's you're using methods that enable you to place rigorous error bounds. You're then able to compare to all other methods and say, okay, well, are these results coming, you know, within this boundary? Are they outside? You know, so on and so forth. And then you can compare runtimes and things like that.
So with all these different methods, like, how did they arise? Has the community kind of been all working together, or specific groups making them up? Like, how are these different variational, all these different circuits coming about?
The variational methods have existed for a very long time. They've existed, you know, even in classical. And there was an algorithm that was produced, you know, that was proposed in the, you know, maybe 2010, 2015, that time span, where, you know, people showed that you could extend these ideas even to a quantum computer. Error mitigation as an idea is also perhaps, you know, 9 or 10 years old, and that's really enabled the operator estimation piece, you know, trying to measure observable estimation piece. Trying to measure observables with rigorous error bounds. This has absolutely been, you know, a community-wide effort. You know, I say this often: we are experts in building quantum computers and figuring out how to extract useful information from these, how to manage errors, and so on. But really, there's an entire community of experts from different fields who know what are the problems that are challenging for them to execute on classical alone, and that input has to come in.
We talked about how now really is starting to become the time that quantum is, yep. you know, beginning to be competitive with classical. So in these three different regimes of validation that we're talking about, how close are we?
That's another great question.
That's a big question.
Yeah. So once again, it ties to something that I just said, which is I'd consider myself an expert in trying to build a quantum computer, trying to figure out how to use it, but not in knowing what the classical state of the art is. Right, and so, if you think of a typical, you know, collaboration on a project of this kind, it would involve, you know, either someone from the external community saying, hey, you know, we think there's a proposal for a quantum advantage because we are experts in this particular field and we know all the classical methods that have been used, and we know what the classical state of the art is, and let's try this. Or it could, you know, involve, like for us, approaching another classical group saying, hey, we've been able to execute these circuits really well. Can you help us benchmark our experiment? Can you help us, you know, can you tell us what the classical state of the art is?
So this is actually interesting, right? Because on the one side, you have these folks who are already using classical state of the art methods that
right.
they think are really good.
Right.
And you sort of come in with like this quantum sledgehammer
right.
and say, oh, actually, I think we got something that beats that. But then we don't actually know if that classical method is very good, is the best yet, even if you give a better quantum solution.
Right, exactly. You'll very quickly discover that what state of the art is, you know, it has different meaning for different people in the community, right?
Yeah.
And this is played out so many times, you know, in our internal, like in our collaborations, you know, say internally or even with external classical simulation folks. It's also played out, you know, when you see high impact prominent papers on the archive, and then there'll be like this.
It feels really good for quantum to come out and say, I did it. And then you say, oh, I ran that on my laptop.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I'm very familiar with that. A big part of this was, you know, are there well benchmarked problems where everyone accepts that, you know, that this is the best classical method, this is the result to try and outperform, or is there a way to speed things up, beyond this kind of, you know, small research collaboration where you can essentially open things up for anyone to contribute to the project,
right?
For anyone to be able to tell you that, you know, hey, I have a new classical solution. That's better and amazing. You know, if that outperforms whatever you whatever you ran on the quantum device. Terrific, great. Science has moved in the right direction.
Computing, you found a better way to do a compute problem.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, terrific. And you're enabling us to zero in on what are the examples of circuits or problems or parameters where there could be a solution, right? And the nature of all of these different classical methods, you know, is that there are approximate methods, and they work in certain regimes, and they don't work in certain regimes, right? And so every time you have a new classical algorithm come in as well, it's also teaching you about what are the kind of parameters where those there's this new state-of-the-art method doesn't work, and that also gives you now a new example to try with your quantum device, for instance.
Got
right?
it.
So this is exactly how, you know, science should progress, and you know, coming back to your question, it can only be a community effort to be able to determine if things have been rigorously checked, you know, and once again, you know, and it also what it also implies, even though I haven't said it this way yet, is that it can't be a single moment in time that one announces quantum advantage. It really has to be this community-led validation of like, okay, yes, we trust the quantum solution, for instance, or you know, within whatever bounds you can place. And then, you know, some community-driven classical benchmarking of the problem as well, where different groups, you know, from anywhere in the world can try all their favorite classical algorithms and say if, you know, this is the result we got, this is the kind of runtime, you know, we require to get to the solution, these are the kind of classical resources, this is how much, you know, it cost maybe.
Right. So this really is this level of, you know, I think what it sounds like to me is that what these three kind of different categories means that you're trying to almost wrangle the troops around a certain set of problems because, you know, if everybody kind of agrees on these as being the three different ways to validate and then starts digging into publishing results in these three different categories, then it really helps focus the field around these so that there isn't somebody at some mega supercomputer organization who just hasn't been paying attention and then shows up and, you know, kind of is like, oh, I actually did that in 20 seconds. But, you know, kind of like the more you can get the community riled up around these things, then the better chance you have that you actually will have one of these advantages emerge and then actually stay an advantage for a while.
Right, right. And it doesn't even, you know, necessarily need to be, you know, people don't necessarily need to be riled up, right? I mean, they could even, you know, they could even think of coming up with their own proposals for what could be a potential place for advantage. And eventually what I would really love for this to be is, you know, once again, for really everyone to realize that with quantum and classical together, we're moving in the direction of a new computational tool rather than pit quantum and classical against each other, right? And this is what we, you know, often mean when we talk of quantum-centric supercomputing as a platform of, mm-hmm. of using, you know, the best of classical, the best of quantum, to perform new computational tasks that we couldn't have with classical alone.
We'll definitely get a bit more into that, but I wanted to first get a bit into these specific things because we already kind of talked about the utility and usefulness about quantum computing and about sort of that they're already doing things classical computing can't do. But it's more like there's computations that, you know, for we'll say useful or science, like relevant computations that quantum computers are in the midst of trying to outperform classical on, right? Do those circuits, these problems that we're using to benchmark these, is there sort of an imagined route to making those useful? Basically, all I'm saying is like, we have these three awesome ways to benchmark quantum circuits against classical only methods. When are those, like, are those eventually going to provide value too?
Right, right, exactly. So that's exactly the essence of this part, right? Of first trying to establish classes of problems and circuits where we have carefully validated the quantum solution and benchmarked against state-of-the-art classical methods, you know, done with the community. And once you have those examples, that could motivate, for instance, you know, research into how do these kinds of circuits connect to problems I care about in my area of expertise.
Right? My airplane routing problem looks exactly like this peaked circuit problem you were talking about, and then easy peasy, I can almost have this verified thing to start building.
Right, exactly. And so this is certainly one way to find, you know, advantage for particular use cases. You know, there could be more empirical ways as well. That one could hunt for this, and we should be open for, you know, happy surprises.
as with, you know, most of science. But yeah, this is exactly what we hope, you know, identifying, you know, catalogs of circuits that have been, you know, rigorously tested on both quantum classical, and then using that to motivate how does this connect to a particular use case.
How are you catalyzing? You're actually doing some work to try and catalyze the community around finding these and extending these advantages, right?
Right. No, absolutely. And I think maybe a month ago or so, we launched what was, you know, what's called the Quantum Advantage Tracker. And this has been tremendously exciting. And it's a very different way of doing science. Experimental physicists often have what's called a lab notebook, where they kind of, you know, they write down, okay, I came into the lab today, you know, I did this was my hypothesis which I wanted to test, and this is what came up. And usually these lab notebooks, you know, just stay inside the lab.
Right.
No one ever gets to see it. You know, maybe you get to see it if, you know, someone wins the Nobel Prize and you want to go back in history and see, like, what did they write when they first saw the discovery for the first time in their notebook, right? What the external community gets to see is a research paper, which is the culmination of many pages, you know, or many days or weeks or months of lab notebook writing.
Right.
And we're almost getting a bit of openness to that process now, right? Where in real time, we are essentially updating, you know, for the world to see results from quantum and classical groups emerge, right? So just yesterday, we had an entry into this public community-driven quantum advantage tracker, which was an experimental result that was basically a day old. And this really, you know, is going to accelerate this process. One, it makes it completely open. It, you know, anyone can view the data. Anyone can submit an entry in these different classes of problems. Anyone can keep track of what's going on. People can propose, you know, new circuits. People can propose new methods. So, for instance, even for us, you know, there's such a big growing family of error mitigation methods. For instance, to make this example a little more concrete, so say we have a circuit we have benchmarked classically, and we think that this particular circuit really is challenging many state-of-the-art classical methods. And we want to test this performance out. So maybe today I want to go and try this particular circuit with error mitigation method A. Okay. Then 2 days later, I want to try this with error mitigation B. Right. In the traditional way of doing science, you might wait till all of these methods are tested, and then you want some you want to report this in a paper that's going to take weeks and months to put down, and then goes through peer review, or it might be on the archive. Right. But this is a very long process.
Each of those methods is going to be a paragraph in a science
paper. Exactly. Instead, if I've tried method A, can I report it publicly today?
Yeah.
If I run method B, can I report it to the external community next week? Right. This really accelerates things. Now, in the meantime, a classical simulation group comes along and says, hey, this particular circuit you thought was really good, well, I can simulate that on my laptop, right? Great, we've learned. So now we start trying things on the next classical circuit, right? On the next quantum circuit, which perhaps, you know, has changed some parameters, some aspects of the problem to make it challenging even for the new classical simulation algorithm. So all of this, you know, really, I hope, moves in the direction of accelerating this feedback loop tremendously, breaking boundaries where you aren't limited to just a limited set of groups, but anyone in the world can contribute on the quantum side, on the classical side. And it just moves science, you know, much faster than, you know, it otherwise would in the traditional sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually kind of beautiful if you think about it, right? Because it is, you know, you said that it's very different than traditional science, but it's actually the definition of traditional science. Like, we have three hypotheses, right? The hypothesis is that quantum is better than classical for these three different techniques. And then, what do you do when you have a hypothesis? So scientists all try and either prove or disprove the hypothesis. So us quantum folks are coming out with better and better programs that can, you know, say, yes, look, quantum is better. And then, as is typical with science, you also have people who are running the same tests trying to falsify the hypothesis. Unfortunately, I feel like a lot of people don't know the scientific method in its purest form, but the purest form is really like, I hypothesize this thing is true, and then I now have to try and prove it false a lot. And it's like, we're all now, instead of us in the lab trying to prove it false and then publishing one time we tried proving it false, it's like everybody at the same time is all trying to prove these hypotheses false. And then quantum advantage emerges as a sort of beautiful flower that, you know, okay, we all tried to prove it false, and the last person, you know, it's been a really long time, we're all trying, and now it's just, it's really, it seems like quantum stayed ahead at the end of us all.
And it's really exciting. I think, you know, already we have probably 10 institutions that are contributing to this in less than a month. I'm really hopeful and confident that this number will grow, and it'll really become something, you know, that the whole community embraces. And yeah, as you said, you know, there's really no shame in one method, you know, beating another. It's really like this is all moving science forward, and a couple of weeks ago, you know, we had a posting of a quantum experiment, the results from that. And then, you know, there was a posting from, I think, the University of Wisconsin-Madison saying, hey, you know, we get better energies than your quantum result. Great, you know, and this is something, you know, that we're incredibly proud that, you know, people are beginning to use this tracker in this way, where we learned about your method, you know, much faster, you know, perhaps than we otherwise would have. And everyone begins to contribute and learn, you know, at a much accelerated pace.
Awesome. And so now this is the question that I'm like really excited about, because we always talk about quantum advantage as this major milestone. It almost feels like the finish line of quantum computing. But in the paradigm you're setting up here, once you hit quantum advantage, you actually just have a bunch of really interesting circuits that we know are like quantum better. But we don't actually have this sort of like explosion of quantum killer apps. And so, you know, then the question kind of remains of like, okay, well, once we've have these quantum advantages emerge, then what?
So once again, it's a matter of scale and gate count. You know, we were talking of examples of quantum advantage emerge, you know, at the 5,000 to 10,000 two-qubit gate level, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 two-qubit gate operation level, right? But there are many, you know, well-known classical algorithms or well-known quantum algorithms that would require, say, millions of gates or billions of gates. And going in that direction of being able to execute so many of those gates is really our path towards fault tolerance, right? So what we're hoping to learn in the near term or in the immediate future are what are those examples of circuits problems that I really would love to see use cases being mapped onto already at this kind of scale, which already we see are examples of, you know, computations that are challenging for classical alone. And then it's really filling those spaces as we go along, right? The path towards building more powerful quantum computers, the path towards fault tolerance is essentially going to take us from a regime where we can execute circuits from a few thousands of gates to millions and billions of gates. And then there'll be different use cases which will apply for every era almost of this journey.
And then the thing we're not really talking about, but you brought it up before, is, you know, I think maybe having had this conversation, people still might feel a little bit like it's quantum versus classical. But when these quantum methods are succeeding and being extended, often there's like a classical HPC workhorse that's helping it succeed. So it's like the classical HPC cannot do it alone, but, you know, the little quantum that could combine with the classical HPC is now like kind of giving it wings to fly. So it seems like that's going to really be a big piece of it too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're seeing so many examples of this. Ground state energy calculations that I was alluding to on quantum computers for fairly large complex physical systems, but they're only being able, you know, they're only being run on these quantum computers today because there's a classical HPC piece that's working in tandem.
Right.
And we'll see many more examples of this kind of work where it'll almost, you know, be fairly obvious that this is the future of computing.
I mean, then it's literally, it's like goes full circle here. It's literally this GPU, you know, CPU versus QPU, CPU price performance trade-off. It's all about like how much quantum do I need to make it cheaper to run it on a quantum plus classical than classical alone, which is already, people are so familiar with this idea if you've ever used, you know, a GPU when you're doing calculations.
Right. And I think here you'll probably see examples very soon where it's not even a matter of just price performance. It'll be like, it'll be examples of, it would have been impossible to do this on classical alone. The only way to do this was because you were able to integrate a quantum piece inside, you know, inside your traditional CPU, GPU space.
Awesome. So I wanted to start wrapping up. This has been a really fun conversation, but I had, first off, maybe is just, what would you suggest somebody, I mean, really this has been a community call to action. You want people who are gonna come in and on both the quantum and classical and then classical alone side, just try and break this. Try and figure out how to do this in a way that quantum, you know, how to, just try and basically get quantum advantage to emerge from this mess. So what would you recommend to somebody who's getting excited about this?
So it depends on your expertise, I guess. You know, if you're a domain expert, you know, really educating all of us on what are those problems that are really challenging in your area of expertise that could potentially be mapped onto these kinds of circuits of 5 to 10,000 gates. That's really, you know, we need the domain experts to be telling us that.
Like the literal, like the guys who and gals who do computing at the plane companies and train companies and candy companies. Just like, if you have a problem that's really hard, we won't know if it's good for these circuits until you show it to us.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, right? You know, certainly the classical simulation experts, you know, to also help, drive our collective understanding of where are those regimes where some of these state-of-the-art methods fail. I think that's you know, a very natural entry point. I'm quite optimistic that this will grow to be an effort that everyone from universities, national labs, you know, industry, even you know, some of our hardware competitors, even, you know, really embrace is a path to collectively understand, you know, what is a rigorously validated quantum result, what is, you know, a rigorously benchmarked classical solution, and then that will drive our understanding of a credible claim of quantum advantage.
Cool. Well, if you're optimistic, then I'm optimistic. So maybe I'll end with just, you know, given this optimism, what do you hope the world with fully realized quantum computing will be like?
As I said, you know, one of the really fascinating things here in this field for me was, you know, the very rapid transition from fundamental science to computing technology. And so I really hope that this is computing technology that performs computations, solves problems that have a positive impact on society. I would very much love for the footprint of this positive impact to happen, you know, a lot sooner than many others imagine. I would love for, you know, great use cases to emerge from establishing quantum advantage even at the 5 to 10,000 gate level. I think if that happens in particular, it'll really accelerate our ability to find examples as we go from, you know, thousands of gates to millions and billions of gates. So I think.
Awesome. Well, cool, Abhinav, this was really fun and I'm really glad we had you on the show. And
Thanks,
I'm sure you will be forced to come on the show again at some point.
Great. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed our chat too.
Yeah, thank you. That's it for this episode of the Coherence Times. If you enjoyed the conversation, please be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with somebody who is curious about quantum computing. So you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube via the IBM Research Channel. And for more episodes, resources, and deep dives, please visit us at ibm.com/think/podcasts. I'm Ryan Mandelbaum. Thank you for tuning in. And remember, the quantum future isn't just coming, we're building it right now.